there are so many reasons why I should have failed, you know, the dot-com crash and Atrax going bankrupt and this and all kind of ostensibly out of my control. But you know, who cares? Nobody. Nobody cares. There's no ever excuse attached to any CEO.
That's the voice of Ben Horowitz, co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz and former CEO of Opsware and LoudCloud. Ben has shared much of his wisdom in two books, The Hard Thing About Hard Things and What You Do Is Who You Are. Ben tells it like it is when it comes to the extraordinarily hard aspects of achieving startup greatness, and from the position of someone who's lived it and has the scars to prove it. This is Mike Maples Jr. of Floodgate, and it's go time with Ben Horowitz. Welcome to Starting Greatness, a podcast dedicated to ambitious founders who want to go from nothing to awesome super fast. When you're a startup founder, you have to channel your inner James Bond, your MacGyver, your Wonder Woman. I'm going to help you win by curating the lessons of the super performers, but before they were successful. So without further ado,
ignition sequence start.
Let's get started. It's awesome when a startup makes it to the promised land. But Ben Horowitz shows us that too often people romanticize the things that went right and focus on pithy recipes to capture the magic of success. The hard truth is that startups are hard. The hard thing isn't setting a giant goal. It's having to fire folks when you miss it. The hard thing isn't creating an org chart. It's getting people to communicate and operate the way you want once you set it up. The hard thing isn't having big dreams. It's dealing with the near-death experiences that keep you up at night with nightmares. Ben has certainly lived through extreme versions of all these problems. We're lucky that he's willing to provide his thoughts about the real stuff where there are no easy answers, and in a way that helps others navigate their anxieties as they face the struggle. Let's catch up with him.
All right, Ben Horowitz, welcome to the podcast.
All right. Thank you, Mike. How are you?
I have no complaints. Well, maybe a few, but I think I should be good to go. So, Ben, you've had a few 0-1 interesting success stories combined with living to tell the tale, I suppose. And so I thought it might be fun to start with the first one. You know, my understanding is you come to Netscape, and it's been a major blockbuster success. It goes public as a 16-month-old company. And now all of a sudden, Microsoft puts its core product out of business. And you need to make the next line of business go from 0-1. What happened there?
Yeah, no, it's kind of crazy times. So, you know, we launched the product and it took off like, you know, no other product had ever taken off at that point. And remember, we're in the days of packaged software then. So people didn't have the internet. The way they got the internet was they went to Fry's and they bought Netscape in a box. And so it was really fast takeoff for a product like that, just unbelievable, which led the company to be able to IPO, you know, right 16 months after we, like after founding.
Right, after zero.
So people don't understand that now. Now it's like, I think the average in venture capital is like 8.25 years. So this is 16 months. So a lot faster than people do it now. You know, we went public August 9th, 1995. And of course, you'll remember the other thing that happened in 1995 was Windows 95, which was kind of, a lot of people would consider that the first good version of Windows. And inside of Windows, Microsoft was going to bundle the competitor to basically Netscape Internet Explorer. So that was a major threat, and a major threat that was looming. You know, I think that they released it shortly after we went public. So it was something everybody knew was coming, and they did all these events, and they did the ridiculous Start Me Up with Steve Ballmer dancing and all that that you remember very well. Yeah,
Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Right around that time, wasn't that when Bill Gates came out with that memo called the Internet Tidal Wave and said, we used to be a PC company, but now the internet's an existential threat and there's this company, Netscape.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like they targeted us. It kind of essentially became illegal to target a company the way they targeted us after that. I think, you know, they went to all of our investors on Wall Street and like would like analyze our quarterly reports and how they were going to you know, use their monopoly to squeeze life out of us. And it was just like the most aggressive thing, because it was all before the consent decree and all that kind of stuff. So it was the most competitively aggressive Microsoft you could imagine, when they had 97%, I think, market share on the desktop operating system. So it was a very tough competitor. And, you know, then the browser was still growing, you know, very strongly at that point. But we knew, and we had said on the roadshow that, you know, like the servers were going to be the thing that, you know, because of course they were going to attack the browser, but we would build these server products and so on. And I was product manager on the web server.
Lucky you.
Yeah. And, you know, I got there, you know, I was hired in, you know, probably 6 months before the IPO to be the web server product manager. And I'm talking to the, you know, the engineering manager. I'm like, well, how many guys do we have working on this thing? He's like, two. I'm like, okay. You know, and it was Rob McCool and his brother Mike McCool. And they had been, they were at the they had written the NCSA web server. And Jim Clark had tried to kind of move them, transfer them from the University of Illinois to Stanford, but they never went to class, so their grades weren't good enough, and Stanford wouldn't accept them. So, you know, they were still in Illinois, and they're working on the Netscape web server, but, you know, they had to finish school. It was just like all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so we quickly were kind of building the web server team and trying to put it together and so on. And then I think it was like October of 95, we got our hands on IIS, which was the Microsoft web server, which, you know, we had two web servers. We had a regular web server, which we sold for $1,200, and then secure web server with SSL in it, which we sold for $5,000.
Written by McCool and McCool.
Yeah, written by McCool and McCool. And these guys, Microsoft's web server, we benchmarked it, and it was five times faster than our web server, and it had security built in, and it was free. We knew it was going to be free, so we were like, oh boy, we're in a lot of trouble. And so, you know, the late, great Mike Homer and I kind of embarked on this strategy to basically assemble a open internet competitor to Backoffice. And so we bought a mail server, you know, which is going to compete with Exchange. And then we bought like some, you know, collaboration tool. And then the big kind of underpinning was we cut this deal with Informix to give us unlimited Informix seats for $50 a copy to use with the web server. And that was the coup de grace, because, you know, SQL Server was a big money maker. They weren't going to give that away free. And so we really kind of had them, and we were going to come out with this whole thing. It was going to be a suite. It was going to be called Sweet Spot. So we compete with Backoffice, and it was going to be our kind of answer to this, you know, very fast web server that they had. And we're coming out with it, and we're going to announce it. I think it was like March 5th in New York. We had this massive show we were going to put on. And then on, I think it was February the 12th, it was right around Valentine's Day. Maybe it was on Valentine's Day. Mark was on the cover of Time magazine. And in those days, like, it's not Time magazine now, whatever, Benioff's pet project, nobody reads it, that kind of thing. It was like, that was the ultimate cover. Like,
if you were on the cover of Time magazine very often.
Yeah.
Back then.
Yeah, right. I mean, Andy Grove was on once, you know, like, it was a very, very prestigious thing to be on the cover of Time. You were like really big. And I didn't know Mark very well then, because I was just a product manager, you know, he's the founder, CTO, whatever. And so then on February the 19th, Mark, you know, 2 weeks before the announcement, leaks the entire story, like every single bit of what's in the product, to Computer Reseller News, which was, you know, it was a big bar publication.
It's not exactly Time or anything else, though. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, given we had this huge event, it was a little bit off. And it kind of, you know, we had been working on it so hard in marketing and, you know, product management. And so I was so frustrated. I sent an email to Mark that said, I guess we're not going to wait for March the 5th to announce this thing. You know, and I forwarded the Computer Reseller News. I was so mad. And he writes me back. He replies, and he CCs Mike Homer, who was my boss's boss, my boss, and Jim Barksdale, who was the CEO. And he writes me this really profane reply that says, look, you don't seem to understand. We're getting killed in the market. And it's all server product management's fault. You know, my fault. Forget I had two engineers or whatever. You don't know what the fuck you're doing. Next time, do the fucking interview yourself. Fuck you, Mark. And so I was like, you know, at that time, you know, like I had a wife and three kids and, you know, I didn't have much money and I kind of needed the job.
Not good for your 360 degree review.
Yeah, and I go home with the email and the Time magazine cover and I show it to my wife and I'm like, what should I do? She's like, definitely you need to go start looking for a job right now. It's like, you're in a lot of trouble. But it ended up working out.
I mean, now you guys are Andreessen and Horowitz. So something happened between that email nasty gram and you guys come into some understanding about how to work together. Like, what happened? What's up with that?
You know, Mark, you got to remember, Mark was only 22 at the time. So he was a kid. And, you know, and a kid with a lot on his plate and a lot on his shoulders. So, you know, he got a little more mature over the years, I would say. But the big thing that happened is, you know, Netscape was really hard because, you know, Microsoft was just trying to put us out of business the whole time. Like, it's rare, like, competitors try and beat you. But they rarely try and like remove all your revenue, and they rarely have a monopoly that they club you over the head repeatedly with. Like, it was just a very different kind of thing. Then I think, like, I haven't seen, you know, people got pretty worked up about like Facebook cloning, you know, one of Snapchat's kind of products with Stories. But that was like really mild compared to what Microsoft did to us. I mean, Michael, I give you like one just like small example of that. We cut a deal to bundle because, you know, they were going to bundle with Windows 95 with Compaq Computers, who was by far the biggest PC manufacturer of the day, to bundle Netscape Navigator with every kind of Compaq computer that went out. And we do the deal and we announce it, and it's top of the fold, Wall Street Journal, like biggest news in tech. And later that day, they call us up and they say, you have to let us out of the deal. And we're going like, fuck are you talking about? Like, we did the deal, we announced in the journal, everybody liked it. Finally gives you a little leverage against Microsoft, you know, what you need. They're like, you don't understand. Microsoft has told us if we don't break this deal, we don't get Windows 95. Like, biggest PC manufacturer in the world. And we're going to go bankrupt in like 3 weeks. So we had to let them out of the deal. But like, you know, like Facebook didn't do anything like that.
You ever get a feeling somebody doesn't like you?
Yeah. So it's a very, very, very difficult thing. And, you know, when you're in a tough time like that, what happens is like a lot of people panic, a lot of people quit. A lot of people don't really want to face up to the music. And so the kind of people who were there kind of willing to deal with that all became very close friends. And, you know, like, you know, Mike Homer was amazing. And Peter Curry and those guys have a good feeling about them forever. And I think that's largely how we became friends.
So then I guess things kind of turn a little bit when you decide to start a company with Mark. So I suppose by the time you started LoudCloud, you had a different, you know, both Mark and, you know, Mark and yourself had a different idea of what the relationship was about. So like, how did you get talked into going from you know, that kind of a zero to one to this kind of a zero to one kind of situation?
Yeah. Well, it was funny because, you know, I was kind of like relatively happy being acquired. You know, I was in a different stage of life. I mean, I had, you know, like I said, I had kids. I was 33 at the time. And, you know, I was just trying to feed the family. I wasn't trying to be, you know, anything. I was just very happy that I could, like, you know, all the kids and go to school, and they were public school and stuff. But that was good. You know, like, I went to public school. It was fine. I could afford a house at that time with my Netscape money, which was good. I could move out of the apartment. And so like that was how I was thinking about life. And, you know, everybody at AOL, I was kind of very highly rated person at Netscape. So, you know, they were willing to give me whatever. And I was very satisfied in that sense. But, you know, Mark and Tim and Insect, they really want to start a company. And, you know, AOL was kind of, it wasn't our company, it was their company. It was a little different feel to it. And they actually like talked me into kind of joining the founding team with them, and then like, you know, figuring out the idea and all that kind of thing. And I can never forget this. I was like, who's going to be CEO of this thing? And they're like, you. It's like, me? What the fuck? You know, I don't know how to be CEO. I'm not that skill set. But that's kind of how it started. And, you know, we did know from being at AOL that people didn't know how to run stuff on the internet. And because AOL had this funny thing, it was called AOL Online. And AOL Online, at the time we were there, was bigger than Amazon, if you can believe it.
Oh, yeah.
And AOL itself had half the traffic on the internet went through AOL. So 50%, like amazing, crazy. And then the AOL Online, AOL Shop Online at AOL was like a mall. So you would basically, Nordstrom's would pay AOL $10 million, and then AOL would put them in the mall. But the problem was they would give them all the traffic and Nordstrom would tip over. It would just blow up. And so we were like, oh, somebody needs to run these things for these guys. You know, there ought to be like a, you know, a software cloud where you can just put your software and it'll just run and keep it reliable and all that kind of thing. And that was the idea for LoudCloud. Turned out it was a little early for that idea, but that's what we started in 1999.
So you started LoudCloud, and when you started it, did you start with an idea of that's what it was, or did you all three kind of more just like think, let's start a startup, and went off to go ideate and figure out what the startup idea
was? It was kind of, you know, in between. It was a little more, and I would say this was a mistake relative to Netscape. So the good thing about Netscape is it's basically there was a product and everybody wanted the product, and then the company had to get built to deliver the product. Whereas LoudCloud, we did go through a bunch of different ideas, all of which like eventually were good, but that, you know, probably none of which would have been good at the time. But LoudCloud was the one that it just seemed like such an obvious thing that was going to have to happen, that there was going to have to be a computing cloud. And we thought, you know, if we thought of it, it must be time to do it, because and we felt we were late, but of course we weren't late in retrospect.
And when you look back on it, sometimes I find that when people start their second startup, they get a little bit enamored of some of the cultural trappings. You know, they spend a lot of time thinking about what to name their conference rooms. They write that, like, they define their culture. They write the employee manuals. They do a bunch of the stuff that the first startup did later, but it's just so fun to be in a startup again that they just start doing startup-y stuff.
We did a bunch of wasteful, dumbass things. It was kind of done with a different lens, but in a way it was the same. It was a similar mistake in that we were like, okay, we had so much demand so quickly that we just put a huge amount of emphasis on how we were going to scale the organization. Because we knew, like I knew that all the mistakes we had made at Netscape in terms of how to scale the organization.
We had to build the company to fulfill the demand, and we built it like super fast. And we did, you know, we had a huge emphasis on, you know, training and onboarding and all these things that we didn't do at Netscape. Because we knew, like, okay, if you try to grow a company without doing that, you're going to have a problem. You know, then the dot-com crash hit and, you know, things started going south very, very fast. And the company was too big and the product wasn't good enough. And like, and at that point.
But what did people think they were paying for when they paid you all this money so quickly?
Well, it's cloud computing. So basically they had some dot-com idea. And there were many of them. You know, one of them I remember was like coupons for groceries. And that was a very rough customer. The One Coupon or something was the name of the company. And they would put their software in our cloud and we would run it. So it was very much like AWS. It was not as like good an interface and that kind of thing. You know, we were in the days before even like virtualization. So, you know, it was a pretty messy thing, but everybody wanted it. Nobody knew how to run this stuff at scale.
So you have all these mission critical customers then, who want to run their websites at scale, yeah, and you're like laying tracks in front of the train and like the revenue
as fast as you can.
Yeah. Yeah, as fast you can. And it's like, okay, now all of a sudden .com meltdown happens.
Yeah. And we're holding the bag basically.
And so like, what did the customers do? Do they say, hey, I'm not going to do coupons anymore. I'm not going to be Nordstrom anymore.
The big thing that happened is, so about 55% of our customers were these .coms, and then about like 45% were things like Fox Sports and Fox News we had, and Encyclopedia Britannica, which were kind of somewhat more robust, although not that much more robust. And then, you know, what you remember, but what, you know, probably most people don't remember today, like venture capital just stopped.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it just went away. Like I never seen anything like it since. Nothing like it has happened since. And so our customers just started going bankrupt at like a crazy rate. And then we had, I mean, just, and then the cost, the other thing is we had built out all this capacity, but the cost of the components was falling like a rock. And I just, the one I remember the most was bandwidth in 1999 was $1,500 a megabit. Mm-hmm. And by 2002 it was $50 a megabit.
Right.
And they were like long contracts. Right. And so if you bought, you know, and it was hard to get bandwidth because they were, it was a great bandwidth build out was happening at that time. So, you know, you had to procure the bandwidth and have it. But then, you know, whatever you were charging the customers ended up being much less than you were paying for it. So it was a, you know, it was basically a spiral.
So you're in this situation. I guess the rational response is to then just go public. So like,
well, so the first thing was, you know, we did successfully raise a Series C round in June of 2000. And that was, but that was like a harbinger of things to come because I was trying to raise my, and it was really a hard round. And I never forget, then this is so funny because it was SoftBank. Like we go to pitch SoftBank, you know, Masa-san. and we come back from the thing and Bill Campbell calls me because he knows the SoftBank guys. And he said, and I'm like, Bill, you know, like, what did they say? And he, you know, he had that gruff voice and he goes, Ben, they said to me, I think your guy is smoking crack. But that's where it was, you know, it's like, you know, you're raising money and people are saying things like that about you. You're trying to build the business. And so we knew that, you know, the round after that was going to be a problem. And we couldn't, because of the things I said, because the infrastructure was so expensive, like we couldn't sell our way out of it. We couldn't cut our way out of it. There was no way out, but kind of up and out. We had to keep like growing the business somehow until like we could absorb all this infrastructure that we had bought. And so, you know, at that point, we tried to raise money privately again. And everybody told us no. And like even, what's the name of the Saudi prince who made the Apple investment and all those kinds of things?
Oh, Prince Alawid, maybe?
Alawid, yeah. Prince Alawid, we went to go see him. He said no. you know, everybody said no. And I had a real moment during that time because when we were looking at the Prince Alawid deal, I remember we're driving in the car in LA. We're looking at the dilution on like what we proposed to them. Like Mark freaked out at me about the dilution. He's like, well, we might as well just fucking give the company away at this point. And I remember I turned to him and I said, if you want to fucking be CEO of this fucking thing, or you want to hire somebody else, please fire me right now. And I could tell by the look on his face that I was stuck in the job. Like I couldn't leave. I was done. Like there was nobody else. Like nobody would take that fucking job. And so, you know, that's where I was. And then we thought, you know, the private markets are dead, but like maybe the public markets are open. And, you know, they kind of were. You know, I went to the board and I basically kind of just told them all the reasons why I didn't think we were ready to go public, you know, including that, you know, we had all these bookings, but the actual revenue was pretty low. And Bill Campbell says, he goes, Ben, it's not the money. I was like, oh, good. We don't have to go public. He goes, it's the fucking money. And, you know, so we got ready to go public, you know, and it's still like, I look at that S-1, it's the craziest thing ever. Like our trailing revenue the previous 12 months was $2 million. We were 18 months old. The trailing revenue is $2 million. We're burning an enormous amount of cash. And we had, when we hit the road, we had 3 weeks of cash. Somehow we got that done.
And how do you, I'm just curious because you've been in a few situations now where it's not just that you're up against trouble, but like you're up against variables that are fundamentally just totally upside down and screwed up, right? Where it's like you're in a plane and it's not even about instrument training. It's like all the instruments are just going crazy at one time and you don't even know which end is up or if you're in a cloud or if you're even upside down in the plane. Like, how do you get your mind around situations like that?
Man, you know, like people always ask me that, and I don't even know if I know the answer. You know, all I remember was like sweating and, you know, my stomach hurting and not sleeping and all these kinds of things. But a lot of it comes down to, you know, can you kind of quiet yourself long enough to go, okay, what are my moves? And then just pick the best one you have. And that was, like, to me, a lot of the story was of Loud Cloud, what I really learned how to do, which I would say very few CEOs are really good at this, is if you've got a very likely death situation, can you make the best choice out of all the horrible choices? And like going public was that. Like we went public just in the nick of time. And like going public, we got so destroyed in the press for it. Like Business Week wrote a story called "The IPO from Hell" while we were on the road. You know, like who's going to buy a stock from the IPO from fucking hell? That's how dumb people thought we were going public. But the alternative was bankruptcy. So like you had to be able to go, okay, this is bad, but the other way is worse.
Yeah. Like you had a lot of decisions that were like, lose one arm today or both arms tomorrow type.
Right. Yeah. No, it was literally like saw your leg off so you can survive. And I sawed off like both my legs, one of my arms by the time it was done.
But the fun wasn't over, right? Because like right after the IPO, you say, guess what? We're not Loud Cloud anymore. We're Opsware.
Yeah. So it wasn't right after the IPO. It was after the IPO. So we went public in March of 2001. In 2001, there were only two IPOs after like probably the most IPOs in history in the prior year. There were two IPOs and one was us and one was PayPal. I think we both sold for the same amount of money, ironically or interestingly, but yeah, you know, us and them went out and their story was also harrowing but, you know, in a different way. And they still like respect and love those guys for getting that off. So we go public. We project $75 million in revenue up from $2 million the prior year because we had all these bookings. But then in the quarter, the first quarter we're public, I think like somewhere around like 40% of our customers went bankrupt. And you know, they were the little ones, which was helpful. But on our very first earnings call, we had to lower guidance from $75 million to $57 million, which is really a bad thing to do. And so, you know, the stock collapsed and, you know, we were, you know, working through that. And then, you know, we started to get it together. We had a couple of good quarters. And then like literally, if you remember, the third quarter was 9/11.
Yeah, I remember.
And that was a crisis. And, you know, so, but we kind of had it together. And then by the end of 2001, in the beginning, it's actually the beginning of 2002, we were putting together what's called a pipe because we had done a huge analysis on, okay, how much cash do we need to get to, you know, cash flow positive and have a fully funded plan. And, you know, we had very optimistic projections and everything, but $50 million, we thought if we could raise $50 million, we had a chance to be okay. And so we had this thing lined up, a pipe. Now we're a public company, so you should be able to do a fucking secondary. But we couldn't do a secondary because like our stock was $4. And so we had to do this thing, a pipe, a public private investment, a public equity. And we had it all lined up and we thought Morgan Stanley set it up for us and we were going to go out and we were going to raise this $50 million. And the day before we were supposed to go on the road, our largest customer, Atriax, which was a joint venture between Deutsche Bank and Citigroup, the CEO calls me to tell me that like they're bankrupt and they're not going to pay us the $25 million they owe us. And so I get the call and I'm sitting in my office and I'm having my one-on-one with my head of HR. And I hear him say this to me. And I'm like, so you're not going to pay me? And he's like, no, I'm not going to pay you. Like, it's over. Like, we're out of money. And I hang up the phone and I can't hear anything. And then I hear this faint in the background, Ben, Ben, Ben. And it's like I'm in a movie, you know, when you're asleep, and my head of HR going, do you want to do this later? I was like, yeah, we'll do it later. Then I was really in trouble because we couldn't raise money. The stock fell in half. So now we're $2 a share. And, you know, $75 million in the hole, no way to raise it. We're definitely going bankrupt. You know, we had to figure something out. So, you know, at that point, I wasn't sleeping at all. So, you know, I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm trying to make myself feel better so I can at least get some rest. And I go, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? what's the worst thing that could happen? I was like, well, worst thing that's going to happen is, you know, current course and speed, we're going to go bankrupt. All the customers that trusted us are going to, you know, we're going to go down and leave them nothing. And they're all going to get fired. I'm going to have to lay off all the employees. Everybody invests in us is going to lose all their money. You know, like my relatives who put in money, they're going to lose all their money. I was like, wow, I don't feel better at all. You know, like that whole trick didn't work. And so then I thought, well, like, what would I do if we were bankrupt? And I thought, well, you know, like, I think the software we built to run the cloud is probably valuable. Maybe I could buy that out of bankruptcy for cheap and start a company. And then, you know, then I had the idea, well, could I do that without going bankrupt? You know, was there a way to do that? And, you know, that's when I got the idea we would sell LoudCloud, the services company, and keep the software that ran it. And I still don't know how we pulled that deal off. That was another kind of like miracle thing. But we sold LoudCloud to EDS and we licensed them Opsware 3 years for $52 million. So we sold them LoudCloud for $63 million and we licensed them Opsware for $52 million. And we had a software company that was public with one customer.
What did Wall Street think of that?
So the stock went on the announcement, the stock went from $2 a share to 35 cents a share. I was doing another stupid thing.
We haven't talked about hedge funds yet. If you had the same experience I had, the hedge funds at the end of every quarter, they've shorted your stock and they're spreading rumors among your big customers that you're going out of business, which can contribute to the outcome, right? Because they might not order your software that quarter.
100%. So they were doing that to us like crazy. There are kind of a couple of stories about it. Like one was they put out a rumor that we had lost a giant deal at Citigroup. We didn't even have a deal at Citigroup, but because of Reg FD, you know, and all my investors were calling me and say, what happened with the Citigroup deal? And I'm like, what Citigroup deal? We're in a deal at Citigroup. And they're like, you're lying to me. And I was like, well, like I can't even say anything because, you know, it's Reg FD. Like I can't say anything to you. And then they thought I was definitely lying to them. So the stock dropped 30% on like a hedge fund. And they actually got unscrupulous person in the press to write the story that we lost a big deal at Citigroup.
Yeah.
And so it just sat there, dropped 30%. And we made the quarter, but like it was a news story and it made customers nervous and all those kinds of things. So yeah, for sure. That kind of thing happened. My favorite story about that though, was there was like huge short pressure that had, and they had pressed the stock, you know, we had gone up to like $3 and they had pushed it down to $1.90. And, you know, and there's just huge pressure on it because the idea is to drive us into bankruptcy so they can, you know, get us done like they were doing to GameStop, for example. Then all of the sudden, like all the shorts blow up at once and we're $3.50 a share, like the stock price doubles. And I go to my head of IR and I go like, what the hell happened?
Yeah.
And he says, they got Movitz'd. And Michael Ovitz, who was on my board, his email address was Movitz, you know, M. Ovitz. And so we called him Movitz in those days. And he said, they got Movitz. And I was like, what do you mean they got Movitz?
What are you talking about?
Michael bought like $10 million worth of stock on his own without telling us. And then we just had to file a Form 4, and the Form 4 came out and it blew up all the shorts.
So then they had to do what's called short sale, right? They had to cover their position by buying stock, and it went up even worse, or better in your case.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Nice. It was a low kind of volume stock. So it went very fast.
And you ended up selling to HP for over $1 billion, if I recall.
Yeah, $1.6 billion, which was quite a thing, you know, coming. We went from 35 cents to 14 and a quarter. So that was
What was that negotiation like? How did you talk HP into paying that price?
Well, this was a crazy story. So we had, just one crisis after another. So it was BMC bidding against HP. So BMC had called me up when we were $8 a share and offered us like 10. I go, no, I'm not selling the company for $10 a share. And the board is like, Ben, what would you sell it for? And I was like, 14. So I told BMC, and Bob Beecham, who was the CEO at the time, was very polite. He's like, well, I can't hit that. And he goes away. But then he comes back 3 months later and he's like, okay, I'll pay $13.75. You know, we called everybody as you do when you get a bid, and, you know, Oracle and HP and so forth. And, you know, Oracle, I talked to Charles Phillips, but he wasn't going to pay, you know, that price. But HP was like coming in and they were going to outbid him. And so they came in at 14. During the deal, Ernst & Young was our auditor and they were also BMC's auditor. And there was an interpretation of how we, which was, it was like a very, very esoteric thing on how we recognized revenue on like three deals that Ernst & Young had audited for us. Like they were audited deals, they were reviewed and so forth. And they're like, well, we're changing our mind. And we're a public company. So that would mean like restatement, which would kill the stock price, right?
Eviscerate, especially in those times.
Yeah. And I'm like, you motherfuckers, like, how in the fuck can you do this? And it was so like, I'm like, we're a customer of yours. Your guy made the judgment. And the three customers were JP Morgan Chase, UBS, and Merrill Lynch, right? So like guys with compliance departments, hard to deal with in a rush.
Yep.
So I say to our auditors, I was like, okay, I'll get all these guys on the phone. And the way you're interpreting now is not what they think of the deal. Because they were interpreting something as a promise that wasn't a promise. I'm like, let's just call the customer and ask them. There's your audit. No, we need like them to amend their contracts. I was like, amend their, I'm in the middle of fucking negotiation here. They're like, if they don't amend their contracts in 24 hours, you have to do a restatement.
Wow.
So I have to tell this to HP and BMC. Like, well, I'm like, okay, I got to go. I have to go do this, but I'm going to go do it. Cause like, we're right in the middle of the negotiation. I can't just like, you know, not disclose it. And so BMC, you know, starts to get cold feet and starts lowering their bid, as is HP. And I got fucking all three companies to amend their contracts in 24 hours. But by that time, like, the whole negotiating dynamic had got.
Yeah, you lost a lot of leverage.
I lost all my momentum. So
a lot of the episodes that we've done on Starting Greatness have been, yeah, there's been near death experiences, but it's been pretty up and to the right. Right? It was like, you know, like Netscape, for example, the world was pulling that product out of Netscape when they had the browser. But you know, you've had a history of being in situations where, you know, the circumstances got pretty difficult. A lot of what you say resonates with me is the reality of what it's usually like in a lot of these companies. You know, what advice would you give to founders about just managing and navigating these crazy sets of circumstances that you faced?
Well, look, I think that, you know, every company goes through a real trial like this, you know. Maybe not every company, but even the companies who you would think wouldn't go through it. Like one of the ones that founders would think is just like had an easy run was Airbnb.
Yep.
But you know, Brian lost 80% of his revenue in a week when COVID hit.
Right, right.
Like so much that, you know, if he didn't do anything, he would have just like literally like run through all his cash and gone bankrupt after all that. And you know, and he faced that moment and he had to deal with it. And I think the good news about it is, you know, for him and anybody who kind of stands up to it and faces it is it makes you a dramatically better CEO and better leader and makes the company better. And I think it's very clearly the case with them. You know, I saw it with Facebook actually in 2007. I mean, people don't remember that, but they were flat for like 10 months with no growth, right? And the executive staff at the time really wanted to sell the company, wanted to sell the company to the point where they were leaking stuff to the press to like make Mark look bad, Mark Zuckerberg, that is. And, you know, he walked through those coals, and that's, I think there are just very few really great companies that get built without going through something like that. Now, most people don't have to go through all the stuff that I had to go through. And, you know, and they probably would have get a better outcome as a result. But, you know, I do think it's part of it. And I don't think you should start a company, you know, if you're not committed to living through that kind of hell. And you don't know if you're going to make it or not. You know, that's for sure. You never know. While you're in it, you do not know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, and I remember you had a saying in your book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, where it was sort of, I think it was something like, nobody cares, just run your company.
Yeah. That was, that's one of my favorite stories. So it was from Al Davis, so the late owner of the Raiders and, you know, kind of former commissioner of the AFL and all that. But it was a story that Bill Parcells told, which was, you know, when he was a young coach, he would go to Al for advice. And he, you know, when he had a lot of injuries on the Giants and he was really, really worried about the team. And Al Davis calls him up. He goes, how's it going, Bill? And Bill goes, well, he's like, you know, like, I'm really worried. I've got so many guys injured. You know, I'm not sure how to deal with it. And he said, and Al Davis says to me, Bill, nobody cares. Just coach your team. And that to me is the best CEO advice ever. Like, there are so many reasons why I should have failed, you know, the dot-com crash and Ernst & Young screwing me over and, you know, Atrax going bankrupt and this and all kind of ostensibly out of my control. But, you know, who cares? Nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know, just run your company and, you know, that's all there is. It's all things considered. The CEO job is never, there's no ever excuse attached to any CEO. Building a company is not glamorous and you're not, you know, it's one of the hardest things, but it's one of the most noble things. You know, you're doing something larger than yourself. You're doing building something from nothing. And, you know, when you do something great, people criticize you and people interpret it as something it's totally not. But it's a great thing. And there's nobody, you know, if you look at the guys who built, you know, some of the companies like Moderna and so forth, you know, without them, you know, we'd be in just a tremendous amount of trouble. So, you know, if you have the will and the idea, I would just encourage it's the best thing you can do with your life.
Well, thanks, Ben. It was a pleasure catching up and hope I'll see you out there in the real world soon.
Yes, sir. Great talking to you, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Starting Greatness podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode or you're new to the show, I hope you listen to our past interviews with legendary founders like Reid Hoffman, Mark Andreessen, the Instagram founders, and Keith Raboy. I'd love to have you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. And if you like the show, I'd be grateful if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow me on Twitter at M2JR and subscribe to our newsletter for exclusive content and events at greatness.substack.com. Until we catch up again, I hope you'll never let go of your inner power to do great things in whatever matters to you. Thank you for listening.